In the last segment, we looked into how Nimrod, through the founding of Babylon, simultaneously not only founded human government, but also false religion. And as we go through this series, we'll see how inextricably government and religion are tied to one another. Even the most self-proclaimed a-religious states are profoundly religious because at the end of the day, their religion is humanism, in which man, rather than God, is the ultimate source of morality, wisdom, and government. In other words, man declares that he himself has unseated and sits in the place of God. So with this in mind, it's really no surprise that the deification of rulers has been a constant trend since Babylon. When a king ascended to the throne in ancient Babylon, he would place his hands in the outstretched hands of the idol of Marduk, and the priest would declare that Marduk had not only granted kingship, but also taken the new king as his son. The king was now the son of the god, and his rule was beyond question. So not only did the king have divine authority in the eyes of the people, but he was himself, in fact, divine. And following Babylon's lead, Egypt took on that idea. Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome all did the same, even Papal Rome, in its declaration of the Pope as the Vicar of Christ, literally he who stood in the place of Christ, deified its rulers, and we still do it, even to this day. We'll get into that further on in this series, hopefully. So going back to the biblical account of the rise of Babylon. In Genesis 11, we read the story of the Tower of Babel. Now, there's some debate today over whether Nimrod had anything to do with the building of the tower. But when we go to ancient extra-biblical texts, such as Jasher and Josephus, both state unequivocally that, yes, he most definitely was. But really, when we get down to brass tacks, it really doesn't matter whether Nimrod was alive or not at that point. He'd gotten that Babylonian ball rolling, and the tower was a manifestation of Nimrod's spirit. Genesis 11, verses 3 through 4, reads as follows. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Okay, this is something I've always thought was interesting. When God had the Israelites build altars to him, he had them use uncut stones, untouched by any iron tools, such as in Deuteronomy 27, verse 5. Completely natural, shaped by God himself. But in building this monument to themselves, Nimrod's followers made their own stones, bricks shaped after their own design. Just something to ponder here. Anyway, they wanted to build a tower whose top reached all the way to heaven. Now, according to Jasher, they wanted to ascend to heaven and fight God. According to Josephus, they wanted a tower that would be high enough so that if God sent another flood, they'd be above the waters. Whatever the case, they were building it in defiance of God. They sought to elevate themselves. Man wanted to ascend to heaven. And this is very much in keeping with Isaiah 14, where God says a taunt will be taken up against the king of Babylon. This king might well be Nebuchadnezzar, given the context of the book of Isaiah. But I think it's worth considering that this king might also be Nimrod, who founded Babylon and infused it with his spirit of rebellion and quest for divinity. The following passage is usually said to be talking about the fall of an archangel from heaven, but its context with verse 4 only allows it to be talking about the king of Babylon. And starting with verse 12, we read the following. "How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the Mount of Assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. This is exactly what Nimrod was trying to do all along, sit in the place of God. If Babylon symbolizes nothing else to us, it should exemplify man's attempts to achieve divinity and make a name for himself. It's the pinnacle of pride and hubris. And I want you to stop and really think about this. There is absolutely nothing irreligious about trying to achieve God status. Even if you don't believe there is a God, trying to put yourself in his place as ruler, as arbiter of truth, as legislator, is a highly religious act. It's the religion of man versus the religion of God. Man is a religious creature. You will never find a single person on the face of this planet who is not religious. The only question is, what God do they worship? In the case of Nimrod and everyone carrying on his empire, that God was man. There is no such thing as an atheist. I repeat, there is no such thing as a true atheist. Because the God slot in human lives abhors a vacuum. Whether it's the one true God, or Allah, or Buddha, or man himself, you will have a God. And the religion of humanism finds its origin in Babylon. At the very least, it finds its institutionalization and codification in Babylon. This great age-long conflict isn't between God and some ethereal fallen angel. It's God versus the creature he made in his own image. It's God versus man, God versus human ideas, institutions, and proclivities. And the culmination of man's human ideas, institutions, and proclivities is the human government established by Nimrod. But even in those early days, God wasn't going to allow Nimrod's followers to achieve their goal of pride and self-worship. We read in Genesis 11, verses 5 through 8, The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Given that, as far as Adamic man was concerned, they were all descended from Noah and really not that far removed from him genealogically, it makes sense that they would all be of one language. And if Nimrod had gone out to conquer the world, he would have brought a lot of peoples, if not all of them, into his imperial fold, the first manifestation of the melting pot concept. And, as a result, their unified goal of a one-world government, so to speak, was definitely within reach. The centralization of their rebellion apparently hinged on their ability to communicate. Language is the medium by which we share ideas and concepts. So, once that was gone, the entire Babylonian experiment hit a major speed bump. The tower was abandoned. Now, personally, I've often wondered if the tower was a literal tower, or if scripture is just being metaphorical. Isaiah 2, verses 12 through 18 uses a tower as a symbol of human arrogance, as we read, For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, against all the hills that are lifted up, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft. The pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of men will be abased. And the Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols will completely vanish. Later on, in Isaiah 30, verse 25, God speaks of a coming day when his people will dwell in peace. On every lofty mountain and on every high hill, there will be streams running with water on the day of the great slaughter, when the towers fall. The day of the great slaughter speaks of divine judgment on his enemies, reminiscent of Armageddon. A tower also seems to signify security and safety. Proverbs 18, verse 10 says, "The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous runs into it and is safe." Now, before anyone gets upset with me, I'm not saying the tower wasn't a literal tower. The evidence seems to point in the direction of literal, but the symbolic significance remains either way. The point is that, in their arrogance, Nimrod's people felt safe and secure enough in their own strength to try to overthrow God. They thought they had the strength and the wisdom to pull it off. But all God had to do was confuse their language, and the whole thing fell apart. Interestingly, after this point, you don't read a whole lot about Babylon. Egypt rises to prominence in the historical text, up until the 10 plagues devastated it right before the Exodus. It's as if Babylon took a long time to recover from this setback. But, as we continue to read, they certainly didn't lose sight of their goal of empire. So, as we come to the end of the segment, we can note three things to take away. 1. Babylon tried to usurp God's power as king of all creation and undermined the foundational family system of fathers. 2. It was the institutionalization of the serpent's promise in Genesis 3, verse 5, that you shall be as gods, which is both a governmental and religious ambition. 3. Ultimately, despite their pride and arrogance, God doesn't have to do much at all to set them back, as we see in the case of the Tower of Babel and the confusion of their language. And this is just the start. As we go along, we'll see that Babylon is characterized by overinflated ego and ambitions of divinity, while God easily puts them down, manipulates them, and uses them for his own purposes. As Psalm 2 says, "The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, Let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain." In the next segment, we'll jump ahead a little in Scripture to the time of Israel's captivity in Babylon and take a look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the image. So far, we've seen a consistent pattern in Babylonian attitudes and ambitions. It aspires to rule over other men and to achieve divinity, which really are both one and the same. It's both governmental and religious in character. And we'll see this fact only further reinforced as we go along.